kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello, and welcome back to Tide, Today in Digital Education, a podcast with me, Di Barnes.
And me, Doug Belshaw.
Hello, Doug.
So this is episode 87 after a couple of months, 2.5 months.
Yeah, no, it's been a long break, hasn't it? So we've had had the summer off and a little bit more.
So you get, you basically get half the year off for summer holidays, yeah?
It's close to that. I'm not sure I actually work for half a year. I don't know. No, I think 4 months off a year. But I work 6.5 days a week.
You do work Saturdays, though, to be fair.
And Sundays. Don't you forget about those ones.
Okay.
So I get officially get a day off a fortnight.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Anyway, what did you do in the time period between last Tide podcast episode and this one?
I've done too many things to mention.
You went to France, though, didn't you? Because you called me from a little cafe. We had the equivalent of a FaceTime call on, was it like Signal or Telegram? And you were in a little French cafe.
It was an app called Ring, I think. Was it called Ring? Is that right? I think it's called
Ring. Did we use that one?
I think we did. Anyway, we did that. So yeah, I was in France. So I spent a couple of weeks in France and met up with Elan Ezekiel and his family out there. And so that was really awesome. I had a really good time. And spent a lot of time programming, working with students over the summer. It was pretty cool. Where they were obviously at home. And so I would just do a bit of programming in the morning over coffee, like a couple of 3 hours a day, and helping them out and improving my ability. I'm not sure I achieved that hugely, but did my best. And so that was really enjoyable, and just lots of managed to get pretty good weather wherever I was, so it was nice. Had a good time. How about yourself? What you've been doing?
Well, as I said to you when you were in that cafe and rubbing my face in it, I worked pretty much all the way through the summer, so I had 1 week off down in Devon. And my wife and mother-in-law managed my expectations by saying that, it's just going to be a bit like camping inside. It's like a cabin kind of thing. Well, it turned out, Di, that this guy had built like almost a spare house while his house was being renovated and refurbished. And they don't like let it out for money. They just kind of, if friends or family or friends of friends need somewhere to stay, they let them stay there. And it was lovely. It was one of these upside down kind of houses in the middle of nowhere in Devon. And I didn't take any devices with me, didn't switch them on. And we watched the athletics because it was World Championships. And that was the only thing I did on screens and just had a great time. But apart from that, just worked all the way through the summer on a couple of things.
Oh my gosh, that's not like you.
I know, I'm usually taking it a bit easier. And actually that hasn't stopped. I haven't had a 4 day week for a few months actually, which is insane. So the things I've been doing, an organization called Freeformers, interesting organization. Go and check them out, freeformers.com.
Yep.
They do work for all different kinds of people, Barclays, some of the banks, etc. But they were doing some work for Google, and they brought me in as kind of the expert, in air scare quotes, to do their Introduction to Code curriculum. And I think I might have mentioned this in Tide 86, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. I know that.
Anyway, so I ended up writing this curriculum. And Laura Hilliger, thanks Laura, if you're listening, kind of helped me out a little bit with it. Wrote this curriculum, Introduction to Code, and then had to do the train the trainer for it down in Birmingham. So, met up with, it was supposed to be about 10, but ended up being only 4 people, and just showed them, 3 of them had delivered Google courses before. They weren't teachers as such. One was a college lecturer. And one of them had never stood up in front of people before, even doing presentations. So it was interesting because they all had the technical knowledge around coding, like more than I do, but they didn't have the how to facilitate kind of skills so much. So we did 3 days of showing them how to do a 5-week, 2 hours a week kind of course. And we actually changed things on the fly, including, those Philips Hue lights that you've got?
Mm-hmm.
So the week one was kind of programming them to work because it would be a very visual way of doing stuff like IFTTT kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Anyway, didn't really work the way I was expecting it to. And so we kind of amended it on the fly because they had the skills. And so, kind of hacking a curriculum on the fly was was really interesting.
Sounds so, good. I just want to pick up on a point there. So I'm in my third week of school, and last week, one of my computer science A level pupils is setting up an after school club. We call them VOLs, here, voluntaries, and it was called Ethical Hacking, and he's into his cybersecurity stuff. So he set up this session, and he got like good take up for it, and everyone rocks up. So the room's heaving and busy with all the workstations full. He had a couple of helpers along, and I hadn't looked at the curriculum at all. So he'd been doing it with my head of department, and so I hadn't seen what he was planning on him. And so we did these cool things. So we set up Kali, I call it Kali's, K-A-L-I, Linux distribution on Raspberry Pis. And got everyone setting those up and using them. Or not using them, he just got them setting them up. And then he got everyone to sign into Pico CTF, which is P-I-C-O and then capture the flag acronym, .com, and register for an account. And there's loads of like cybersecurity, cipher kind of challenges on there. Huh. And so we were working our way through some of those. But he experienced firsthand in at the deep end what it's like to lead a classroom. And how difficult that can be. And people just kind of, people seem to think, oh no, I'd be good at that. I could do that. But actually when you get in there with the people, it's really quite difficult. And when every time I've had pupils lead lessons before in various guises, they all find this. It's just not an easy thing to, the thing that they shy away from more than anything is talking to the whole class in an authoritative way that that has faith in what you've set up and got ready for do, and all of a sudden you're hit like the rabbit in the headlights, as it were, with
it's the non-verbal language which I was trying to get across to them, like the way that you stand, the what you do with your hands, all that kind of stuff.
Well, everything counts. That's the deal, isn't it? Everything that comes out your mouth, every expression that you make, somebody's going to be watching it at some point, and that's the difficulty of being a teacher. You're always on stage. And So this is a real eye opener for him, and I'm looking forward to Thursday's session. And what he had done is he'd not, so you know, you set up the Kali Linux on the Pi, and that was great, but actually it was easier to use it on a normal computer, the thing that we were actually doing, the cipher activities, because it would run faster, because a Pi by its nature is a little bit slow. That was that. But it was all good fun. So I said you kind of had to think through what you wanted them to achieve, and you had to think about what successes they were going to have. They were coming to this hacking vol. They all wanted to be, you know, they've obviously got an interest in computers, and they want to feel like, not like they're complete noobs, but they've got some.
Yeah, you want to feel like you're making progress, and I think that's the difficult thing, isn't it?
You've got a handle on how to progress, I think, is the deal, isn't it? So it was really interesting. A baptism of fire for him. And
The other thing I've been doing is doing some work for, again, something I think I mentioned before, London Connected Learning Centre, one of my clients, now one of the co-op's clients, actually, moved them over. It's part of the Education Development Trust, which do some really interesting work. So if you haven't come across the Education Development Trust, I think they came out of the British Council decades ago, etc. Anyway, we're doing a report on, I'm helping write a report with Sarah Horrocks. Hi, Sarah. I know you listen to this. About kind of technology-enhanced teacher professional development around the world. And so that has given me a chance to read all kinds of stuff, some really fantastic stuff, some really rubbish stuff as well, unfortunately. But one thing which was great was going through Steve Higgins, Professor Steve Higgins, who was my thesis supervisor at Durham, the work that he's done basically since I graduated from my AD. So he sent me through some presentations and some, you know, work that he's done. And he was talking, he's got a quotation, which I'll not be able to get out fast enough now for this podcast, but the quotation was basically saying that teaching is not just, oh my goodness, yeah, it is the hardest job in the world, but it goes through as to why it's the hardest job you will ever possibly do compared to anything else that you think might be a difficult or tricky thing. So, yeah.
Well, I think that's it. No, you put this out in your newsletter, I think.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Yeah. So on your blog, and I agreed with his myths. He had a list of six or eight myths, I think it was, which I thought were bang on the money. So it's worth reading if people go and find it on Doug's blog, if they're not ready.
Yes, I'll put the link. Actually, it's called Digital Myths, Digital Pedagogy, and Complexity. Yes. Mm-hmm. I just stick on my blog because I realized that last week it was the first week for months that I hadn't actually written anything on my blog, which is very unlike me. Wow. Have you written any blog posts this summer, Dan?
It's because you've been busy. What did you say, sorry?
Have you written any blog posts this summer?
No, I've written absolutely none. I've written some tweets. I've written some toots as well on Mastodon. And it's kind of cool. But no, I've been doing a lot of reading over the summer of books and of different sorts.
Any particular ones?
Educationally speaking, I read Dylan William. Is that his name?
Mm-hmm. Daniel Dylan William, yeah.
Or Daniel Willingham. I can't remember. I always get those two
confused. Daniel is Dylan Willingham.
The psychologist.
Daniel Willingham.
The one that's done a book about reading. I could go and get it. It's on my bookshelf in the other room. But he did this thing about the intricacies of reading and how it works in the brain. And that was fascinating in part. It was a little bit long, really, for what it was saying or for what I got from it. But it was really, really interesting in the intricacies of how the brain works in response to reading and the myriad of associations that we make as we are reading and how we develop context and et cetera, and meaning and things. So that was really interesting.
Someone wrote a really interesting thing about Daniel Willingham, saying that every year, at the start of the school year, he writes a blog post about why learning styles don't exist.
Does he really?
So I was saying, like, nobody in 2017, nobody thinks learning styles exist. So why does he write a blog post every year? And their contention was, again, I won't be able to find it because I read so much stuff, but their contention was that because he and others of his ilk believe that the most important thing that happens in the classroom is teaching, as opposed to, you know, trying to think about learning. That's a bit of a crude way of putting it, but you see what I mean? That it's almost dismissing any kind of approach which isn't focused directly on teaching.
Okay.
I did read his book. Was it like Why Do Kids Hate School a couple years ago?
Yeah, Why Kids Don't Like School, yeah. His book, the one I read, is called The Reading Mind, A Cognitive Approach to Understanding How the Mind Reads. Okay. It was good. We'll put a link to the Amazon thing in the old, in the show notes.
Good? You're good?
Yeah, it's interesting. So tomorrow I'm doing a session with our design, engineering and technology department. That is about they're changing their digital workflow towards Google Classroom team drives. So team drives sit within Google Drive. They're a very good thing. Have you seen them?
No, tell me about them.
So team drive is, so you know, if you were a teacher at a school and you walk away and then all the files and you delete your accounts deleted and all your files you created would delete with them, with your account. Well, team drive is a sort of sustainable area that you can save things into. So it's good for teachers to share stuff. And
is it a bit like the team version of Dropbox?
Yeah, it will be like that. So if so, when you delete the teacher's account, all the things that they contributed to the team drive will remain. And so it's just like that. But then some of my I haven't done. I'm a really naughty head of digital strategy because I haven't done any training. So I've rolled Google Apps out, Google Drive or whatever, and just let it grow, kind of thing, and just sort of slowly let people realize how helpful it can be and how many problems it can solve as a set of tools. And then Team Drives has been brought into that. And one department, the math department's using it rather than printing loads of stuff. They've been using Google Drive. And then they want a Team Drive turned on. So I just turned it on and then people started creating drive after drive. So there's like 50 drives being created, Team Drives, sorry, being created and by children as well. It's quite funny. So I've just been going through it today and sent out an email to all staff explaining how they actually work and how they should be used. Because you don't have the same sharing permissions. So when you set the sharing permissions at the top level of a team drive, like who has access to it, if you put children in there, then they have access to everything in it. So then it loses its functionality as a shared drive where teachers can share things like paper, exam papers.
Oh, so you can't necessarily... So when you... Let's say you create a document in there, you wouldn't be able to lock it down anymore. Like the default permissions are the default permissions.
Not quite. To a document, you can change permissions to an individual file, but you can't change permissions to a folder, which means so you create a root team drive called Tide, for example, and then you want to have a folder that's going to include other people in it that are not at the top level of the team drive, and you can't do that. So you can do it to an individual document, but you can't do it to a folder. And really, as a teacher, and you want to have a digital workflow, you need folders to have those kinds of permissions. So that's that's where Google Classroom comes in, and Classroom is for doing that sort of more for working with the pupils and the ebb and flow of learning kind of thing, and it manages the sharing for you, which is really what Classroom's all about.
Interesting. It's all good.
Okay. I read an interesting couple of books this summer. One was by Noah Yuval Harari, who wrote Sapiens, that book about the history of humanity. This one was called Homo Deus, which is about the future. And, you know, it was interesting, but he's basically drank too much of the Google and Facebook, especially Google, Kool-Aid. And, yeah, it just, I don't know, like he doesn't know as much stuff about that as possibly even you or I know. Which is unfortunate. So you kind of left it feeling a bit like, stick to your history, really, because that wasn't so good.
Get out of my head.
But I tell you what was unexpectedly amazing. I was down in Devon, and I'd, because, you know, when you're away from screens, you free up all this time. And so I'd finished this book by Harari, and I thought, well, what should I do next? So Devon Brown, you know, as in the magician, he's written a book called Happy. Have you seen this?
Happy?
Yeah.
No, I haven't seen that. Tell me about it.
So I didn't know much about Devon Brown, but it turns out that at one point he was living on housing benefit in a council estate somewhere and, you know, walking around doing, you know, walk around magic kind of stuff for 100 quid a night or whatever.
Okay.
Or a week, or not very much money anyway. Made his big break. Anyway, he's got a degree in law. And he's always been interested in philosophy and especially Stoic philosophy. So this book, which is quite thick, starts off as being like a bunch of anecdotes about life, the world and everything and magic, and ends up as basically like a treatise on why we shouldn't fear death. It's amazing.
Okay, that does sound quite interesting.
Yeah,
fair play.
I very much enjoyed it.
So well, two books by Matt Haig, who is one of them is on the top 10 seller, and I was buying books off bookshelves at the ferry port before I drove out to France for a crazy amount of money. don't buy books in when you're stuck in a corner, that's all I say. But I read it, and I think it was called How to Stop Time. And that was very good. I was very impressed about somebody who is not immortal, but will live for a few hundred years or whatever, 500, 600 years, and their relationship to the rest of the world because of that. And that's that. And then, so I read a second book of his, which wasn't so good, but quite interesting, called Humans, which is where a university professor from Cambridge has solved the Riemann something or other mathematical conundrum, which is the final piece in the puzzle to how to distort time and travel and things. And he comes down as an alien who lives entirely a sentient being effectively, and describes how humans are. So it's all, there's lots of sort of comical things in that, but ultimately, of course,
things don't make sense.
Of course, everything doesn't make sense, like wearing clothes and things that we eat and whatever. But then obviously he succumbs to the human condition and falls in love or whatever, starts to love people and relationships develop. But it's an interest. It was interesting, you know, but he's a good writer. It was good to read.
Excellent. What else this summer? Oh, I deleted every tweet I've ever sent.
Oh, I saw you did that. Yeah. That's sort of interesting. And you did that so that people can't mine your data, basically, unless they go to your personal blog where you've got them archived.
So just to explain, 77,500 tweets that I've sent in the last 10 years, more than some people, less than others. And yeah, I'm going to the US in November, Washington, D.C. I'll actually be about two blocks away from the White House because I'm doing some work with a large bank. Brian Mathers is coming over. Hi, Brian. And I realized that I've been meaning to, you know, I've been using Mastodon, you know, social.coop a bit more, and, you know, using Twitter a bit less. And I really got hacked off with their privacy policy because they're just turning into Facebook. And the reason why they're turning into Facebook is because they have to grow. And the reason they have to grow rapidly is because of venture capital. Yeah. And the kind of venture capital which isn't very nuanced and doesn't really support the company. It's all about earning money and making a quick exit. Anyway, so I realized that when I get to the border and go into Washington, D.C., I'm a member of the EFF. You know, Cory Doctorow has written today, I think it is, that the EFF has left the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium, over the digital rights management that they've accepted to be part of the web standard. Which is all background to say that when you go through the US border, you're in a very bizarre space where you're not kind of any, you're in kind of this legal limbo land. And it's one of the reasons why Apple, who we'll go into later, have introduced safeguards. I think with Touch ID, you press, is it the home button you press 5 times or something?
I've no idea what they're doing with their phones.
Yeah, to disable Touch ID.
Okay.
And with the new Face ID, which we'll talk about in a bit, you can squeeze the side of the phone to turn it off for long enough. And the reason you do that is because you don't want people to be able to force you to unlock your phone. Because if you unlock it using biometrics, it doesn't count as free speech or some, you're not protected in the same way as you are with PIN codes.
Yeah.
So I realized when I go to the US, what I want to do is I want to back up everything on my phone and my laptop and delete it and then re-download it when I get there. But obviously at the border, you're asked for your social media accounts now, either by default or you can be asked as part of the thing and you have to give it to them. Now, I don't know what they're looking for and I don't know what the keywords are and I don't know what might get me turned around and sent home. So it was actually the proximal cause for me deciding, yeah, I'm actually going to delete these tweets. But the great thing, to Twitter's credit, the thing that they do, Di, is they allow you to back up your tweets in a way, it's just a zip file, and when you unzip it, you can just upload it to anywhere. So mine's just twitter.dougbelshaw.com. And it has all your tweets. They're all linked to the actual real tweets from other people, you know, if it's a conversation, etc. Okay. And you can search them. So it's still useful for me to see what I've said and done, etc. Mm-hmm. But it's just that if someone was trying to scrape it using the official Twitter tools, they wouldn't have access to it.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense because these things are going to be automated. They're going to go looking in the major social networks for you, aren't they? And and so if you have it elsewhere, then it's reserved for your perusal and an archive, as it were, but not available to others to play with.
Hmm. And of course, I didn't have to put that online. I could have kept it offline.
Yes, indeed. So how are you? Have you got a workflow? Are you going to do it every year or every month or something like that?
Well, I was thinking about that, and previously I thought, well, I'll do this just as a backup every 6 months or so. But now with this one, the only tweets that I'm putting on there, Di, are links to my work. So I've got a new blog post or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I mean, I could just keep backing it up, but I'm not really sure what the value is of just keeping backing up links to my stuff when it's already there. So I'll have a think, but I'm not.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's really clear, and you don't want to expend energy that's unnecessary. Yeah. I always think.
Then the only other thing I've written of any value really is, again, London CLC. They're doing some work there with a school that's doing like action research with their teachers who aren't used to writing blog posts. So they asked me if I do some guidance around writing blog posts, and I thought, well, actually, that's the kind of thing I've been meaning to write for a while. So I wrote, I think, 4 posts linked to from this main post called How to Write a Blog Post, just about all different things that you might not think about when you're blogging and the kind of things that you and I will have just got into the habit of doing. But when you're new to it, all of it, just the things you might need to think about.
Oh, that's a handy thing. I'm always looking for useful little one-stop destinations to give people when they're starting out and blogging and things like that, especially teachers when they're starting out with their classes and things. That's cool. Well done.
And the thing I tried to do was to not, I was trying to get myself slightly out of my comfort zone. And in this particular one, it's not massively out of my comfort zone, but you think about what would be the default image that you'd use to represent a post about you advising people about blogging. Well, it would usually be a man, a white guy on there, at the keyboard. But I thought, there's no reason, just because I'm a white guy, that these should be photos of white guys at a laptop. So I went out my way to find, you know, people of color. So there's a women of color in tech chat Flickr group, which Jess Klein pointed me to at one point. And so I used women of color as the you know, images. And it was the first time anyone's ever commented on. And it was in a negative way as well, on what image I used to go with my blog post.
That's a difficult thing, isn't it? I think these issues are very sensitive. I was discussing, don't ask me how I got here in class, but I was discussing with my upper six a book written, I think I mentioned on here before, called Man-Made Language by Dale Spender, which is a book looking at how language is constructed around men. So you have the, you know, everything is defined in the first instance by men, and then women are defined thereafter. The technicalities of that are really, sorry, the intricacies of that are really subtle. That's not a tautology, but it's just very gentle how you accept that sex, for example, is described as penetrative sex. Well, it's not for a woman, it's not the woman's action. So the penetration part is not the woman's action, for example, things like that. And then you have master and how a woman is defined in their salutation, in their title, by the fact if they're married or not. So therefore the relationship to a man. And I've never really understood why that stood up and stood the test of time, really. But people seem to insist upon it. Or just
I sent out a link today on that Thought Shrapnel Live channel from 2015, which was about the kind of cultures where you just have to stand up for yourself and you've got something to say, you should say it kind of thing. Mm. And how it's called uninterrupting interrupt culture. And it's interesting because for the first time, I actually said to my dad, can you stop interrupting my mother, please? When I was around at their house. Sorry, Dad, if you're listening. But you know, like people, I didn't realize I was doing it until someone pointed out to me, at Mozilla. And it's one of those things where, yeah, just it needs pointing out to people, like you're interrupting this person. Do you realize you're every time a woman speaks, you interrupt them? Do you realize that? Doing it in a way which makes them think without being too confrontational.
Yeah, no, I think that it is the point, isn't it? It's how to make it think. I always wonder that. So I'm quite, as I've discussed in here before, quite sensitive to or on the lookout for evidence of institutionalized racism and defining it, and I'm making sure that people around me understand what it is and that I have an issue with it. And I read a fantastic post about written by Nick Dennis, actually. Hello, Nick, if you're listening.
I read this over the holidays.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and it's really, really fantastic post about privilege and about seeing things from other people's points of view and the experiences that you go through because of the difference in your skin color in this country. Just your experience of everything is altered. And it's important that you understand that if you're teaching people of a different skin color to you, and if you're teaching people of different gender to you, it's similar as well, is that you're able to catch yourself when those things happen, you know, like you'll interrupt a woman where you'd listen to a man or whatever, and you just have to be careful and just observant of yourself, which is difficult. And I guess it's called mindfulness of a sort. I don't know. But really good
points. What I really liked about Nick's post was he started off with that quiz of like, which just made you think, oh, I've never thought about those questions before. Like the one where he says, if you do well in a situation, do you expect to be called a credit to your race or to be described as different from the majority of your race? And he goes on, even just things which you'd think of such a little thing about his daughter and his wife can't go to the same hair salon because they don't do ethnic hair or something.
Yes, so his wife is white or Caucasian or whatever, and his daughter is a mix between him and her, and therefore they can't go to the same hair salon. It's a really, really bizarre thing, isn't it? And that's the beauty of this, is clearly becoming a parent, congratulations on being a dad, Nick, that has made him really reflect and look at this in the detail, you know, and that's why this post is so well written, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, this was he doesn't mention it. It's a kind of a bleak reference to David Didow's. Like, I don't know what he was getting at. I don't know if he seemed to not be stirring things up on purpose, but let's not go into it. But it seemed to be as close as to racist as you could possibly get without, yeah. And even, well, let's not go into it, but basically the comments on Nick's post are Some of them unbelievable.
They are, aren't they? And there was a big sort of Twitter storm, I guess is the right phrase, about something that David wrote in blog posts, which I believe since have been taken down. And I didn't read the posts, and I wasn't on Twitter at the time of the storm, and didn't participate, and haven't gone back to read it. But I think the point about institutionalized racism is it's the accumulation of all of these experiences that Nick's identifying on the individual concerned that's going to have an effect on that individual's behavior, and how do you know where is that ever accommodated or accounted for in responses to that behavior, and how should it be done? I don't think it's a really simple or straightforward thing, but what is true is that it's there, it does exist. And whereas many people might think they're not being racist at times, need to step back and have another thought, possibly on certain occasions. And it's a difficult thing to call. I would include myself in that number. And when I read this, one of the things that I did in my own mind was replay every conversation I could remember that I'd had with Nick, thinking, I wonder how he experienced my conversation with him. And whether, do you know what I mean? Because I just wouldn't necessarily be...
Nick and I used to be very good friends, and now we're not. And I have no doubt that I have done something which would possibly be seen as intolerant in some way, which was unusual. But the thing I think about the comments section is really interesting. Now, Audrey Waters, as we talked about before, she doesn't have a comments section anymore for all of the reasons that we have discussed in previous podcasts, and we don't experience as men of white privilege, etc. But some of the comments in here, which Nick responds to in a very measured way, I have to say, and that's always been my experience of talking to him, I can't be done with people who don't read stuff and then comment on it. And also people who say things like, you're just identifying a problem here. You're not talking about what the possible solution could be. Or, which is worse, you haven't read the stuff that I've read, therefore your point is invalid. And all of that happens in this particular comment thread. And that happened on LinkedIn. I was putting, my blog posts on LinkedIn, etc. And there was one in particular, the one where I decided to delete all my tweets. I don't know how much time you spend on LinkedIn, Di. I only really go on there occasionally to, connect with people or, pimp my posts, etc.
Uh-huh.
But there's a definite culture in there. Yeah, isn't there?
I don't go in. So I only go in when somebody mentions it.
People like norming people on LinkedIn. What I mean by that is we do things this way here. And there's a bit of that creeping into Twitter as well. But on LinkedIn, it's extremely prevalent. And it was to such an extent that I knew what the response was going to be to my post about Twitter before I even bothered putting on it. I almost didn't bother putting it on. And so I said on the link to the blog post, this is what I've done. I am not saying this is what you should do, okay? And, and please read why I've done it and, what I've done as part of the whole process. One person who I'll not mention, but I think you know him, he basically commented, I don't think everyone should be doing that. I don't know what the problem is. And you've just lost all your tweets. And what's going on there? And I'm like, first of all, you haven't read the introduction to my blog post, as in like the bit on LinkedIn. And secondly, I've backed up all my posts and said that explicitly in the post. And he kept coming back at me. And I was like, with the greatest of respect,
I don't play tennis. Just
with the greatest of respect, like you're being like every like annoying white male guy ever. And maybe you need to think before you start commenting.
I think it's really difficult. I mean, it is that sort of thing. So the reason I read the book by Daniel Willingham about reading was because I'm really interested, because I set students off on a page of programming tasks quite often. And they so they just don't bother, I think, to read the actual instructions that are on there. They see the task, they home in the task, they skim read it. very intelligent young people doing this, and then they get lost or stuck or not sure what's gone wrong because they haven't read it properly. And that's a similar thing that you're saying there, is that someone is commenting on something without actually reading it properly and spending a little bit of time with the text and the words and what the author meant. So that's what drove me.
Have you ever done that test with kids where it's just basically proving that point? So it's a random kind of set of questions or whatever, and it's got instructions on it, and the instructions are quite long. And the last instruction is only answer question one.
I haven't done that, no, but that is exactly the right thing, and it is to bring things to their awareness. And that's what I'm looking for, is how do you get them to read all of it? And I'm guilty of this myself. It's just, you know, you skim read something at such, well, it's not even skim reading. You just, it's like skipping a stone across the water, really. And it's just no good. It's no good for anyone. No good for me, no good for them when they do it.
What I've realized this summer, though, just tangentially, is it's only really possible to properly skim read stuff that's written well. Because I realized that what I was doing, which I think everyone does when they skim read, is you read effectively the first and last sentence of every paragraph. And if someone writes in a really baggy way, or if English isn't their first language, or they're just not very good at writing, it's almost impossible to skim read.
I think good writing is hard to come by, I think, and not as easy as people make out. And I've been looking at the idea that language language is an algorithm recently, and we've been doing UCAS personal statements that the students have, and so I've been talking to them about their voice and what it is that they're trying to communicate within their personal statement, and how much they're trying to conform to expectation and advice, and how much they're trying to sell themselves or rather than using superfluous words to, like, passion and things like that. To talk about concrete things, but to talk about them cleanly and quickly, with a few words as possible, and that kind of thing, and just to think about their language and try and find a voice and all. It's a difficult thing, writing. So I can imagine that I'm not a skim reader. I just can't do that. I'm an awful reader, awfully slow, and I think that's why I can read tech stuff, because I just force myself to do it. I use a speed reader, a plugin on my browser and on my phone for when an article is quite long, so that I can actually complete it rather than just read the first two paragraphs.
What does that do?
I just puts it in a it just puts it into a little app, a web app or an app on your phone that highlights the central word as it spins through the text at 300 words a minute or whatever speed you want to set it to. So it means that if you've got quite a long article to read and you want to read all of it, it will set it and it will show you it's going to take 4.5 minutes, and you sit there 4.5 minutes concentrating and get into a trance-like state. So I find when I'm tired, which I am often when working, and I want to read something, it's the easiest way to read it. And so it's the best speed reading method I've found, really. But some people...
Oh, cool. Put the app in there. It'd be interesting to try.
Oh, it's cool.
When you're talking about superfluous words and stuff, I've been trying to catch up with BBC Radio 4 podcast, Thinking Aloud. Uh-huh. And I think it was the most recent one, management jargon or, you know, business bullshit, or my favorite term from the program was management piffle. And talking about how organizations try to reduce or abolish ambiguity, and it's always the latest fad that comes out, etc. Uh-huh. Well, the woman who talks on there, Margaret, I've forgotten her name, she is great in terms of cutting through all of the stuff that happens in organizations and the layers of management and et cetera. So highly recommend looking at that, because I do find that every organization seems to be, you know, adding layers of management and introducing jargon. I was at church on Sunday and I picked up the local diocese newspaper and there was a director of discipleship. And I thought, that's something you wouldn't have got 20 years ago.
No, indeed. How things change over time is an absolute truth. I've just put, if you go to the show notes and you're interested, Reedy is spelled R-E-E-D-Y. And I've just done a Google search and put a link to the Google search in it because there's a plethora of apps for all the different devices out there. And I don't want to point anyone towards the Chrome browser or Android or whatever. So you just look on the Google thing on the first page, it's got all sorts of different things for the device of your choice, I think.
Great. Okay. So we're going to try and have a new academic year's resolution of being a bit more focused on the old ed tech as opposed to just tech, I guess.
Okay. So I'm just going to go completely against that. And did you just talk about your thinking aloud link?
Management yes, jargon. Mentioned it.
Yes. Sorry. I was busy doing reading. I think that's management jargon. It's a fascinating thing, I think, to all educationalists, especially those working in ed tech, because you have to bring management jargon or buzzwords or whatever to the table. And it's a really, really difficult thing. So people and someone, it's quite funny. So you choose certain words. So one of the words that I have surrendered to is workflow. Some people just hate the idea because it's this idea that you're summing up something that people do in a simple one word. But I just think it's a word that most people understand. So I carry on using it. And it's a bit like that. So talking about people's digital workflow or their learning workflow and things like that. Yeah,
it's a really interesting episode. Highly recommend it. It's very good.
Yeah.
So we've got some stuff in here. We can do it in any order. There's some stuff around cultural capital in the most boringly titled TES article ever, but it's actually pretty good. Stuff about how being a parent has changed the secret teacher in The Guardian to be better as an educator.
You choose. Let's pick one and we'll go. Okay.
Well, I'd like to start off with a bit of, Apple face unlock stuff. Because I feel like that is something we've already mentioned. And also, it's kind of topical and it floats my boat from a technology and privacy's perspective. And also everyone listening in the next few months will see somebody unlocking their phone with their face, I have no doubt.
Mm. So I've got an interesting take on this. So we're getting Surface Pros in at the school at the moment, as many schools are and or have done already. And they unlock with your face and you can unlock them with someone's Facebook profile. But quite interestingly, the technology that Apple have employed or developed for the release of this device is much, much more robust than that. So you can't fake it with a two-dimensional picture. They've worked with mask makers to make sure that you can't fake it with a mask. And a gentle aside to this, I don't know if you've put a link to it in, is that masks no longer conceal your facial recognition system. So there are things that are distorted to your face. So you can change your hairstyle, you can wear a beard, you can have a mask over your eyes and things like that. And cameras will still be able to identify that it's you, which is an interesting thing. But so the Apple unlocking methodology is really quite technically robust, I believe. Until you get to the point where you have identical twins. So I think that this new, the iPhone X is Apple's first multi-user handheld device, but it's only multi-users for identical twins. It's a niche market.
I've read lots of stuff around this, which I won't bore you with, but reading security expert stuff, they're always talking about a balance between, I was reading something before about the balance between because security people will always say, what is your threat model? Like, if you're Edward Snowden or if you're somebody trying to escape from the government, then you shouldn't use any of this and you shouldn't give any biometrics and everything like that. For everyone else, their threat model is their kid stealing their phone or some bad person or a coworker or whatever, in which case biometrics is fantastic. And I have to say, I'm now using fingerprint unlock on my Android phone because I realized it's much more convenient, and the UK and the US government already have my fingerprints. And
But wouldn't that make But I think it's so. The way to set up an Android phone with your touch thing is that you have when you power on, you need your PIN. Yeah,
that's right.
Have you got that set? So that means that if you are worried about your device in any way, you just turn the power off, and then it can't be opened without your, as you said earlier, with your ultimate, without getting some information out of your head, rather than just sticking it in front of your face or sticking your finger on it.
Yes, that's right. So there's a couple of articles in here. The first one is on a great, great blog, which everyone should subscribe to, called Free Code Camp on Medium. It's just called Why You Shouldn't Unlock Your Phone with Your Face. Now, the specific thing they talk about here is free speech in America. So this is what I mentioned before about whether biometric information counts as free speech. And about halfway down, there is a subtitle, which is, it basically explains everything. Numeric passcodes, hard to guess, easy to change, and legally protected. So that's the deal.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. There you go.
You can be forced by law to hand over to unlock your phone using your iris or your fingerprint or your face. You cannot be forced by law, in the US at least, to release something which exists in your head.
I have an interesting, I mean, this even goes to schools. So I always say to the pupils when talking about passwords, when they first have to set them, when I first teach them, that even if the head gets you in her office and your parents are there, you do not have to give up your password. So I said, every service that we own, we can change your password and go and access your device or your account as you. But you don't have to ever give out your passwords, or you can't be forced to do so. It is your own choice. So you can be asked to do so, and you can agree because you think that's the right thing to do, but you can't be forced to do so. And I think this is a similar sort of principle, but obviously in a more serious situations, I imagine.
Yeah. So some really interesting stuff about that. And if you find this interesting, then do have a look at that. But also have a look at something which blew my mind, which was, if you saw the Apple announcement, I didn't watch it live or anything, I just caught up afterwards with some of the blog posts, etc. But the little, so at the top of my phone and your phone, Di, it's just got a camera. At the top of the new iPhone X, it's got, or 10, it's got a couple of cameras, and it's got like a little scanner to do all the Face ID thing. Well, this blog post by The Verge contends that the iPhone X's notch, which is a little thing at the top, is basically a Kinect. And you know the Kinect that came out with the Xbox?
Yeah. It's Microsoft product, yeah.
Because it says, Microsoft's original Kinect hardware was powered by a little-known Israeli company called PrimeSense. PrimeSense pioneered the technology of projecting a grid of infrared dots onto a scene, then detecting them with an infrared camera and ascertaining depth information through a special processing chip. And that did 30,000 laser dots. So Apple bought PrimeSense in 2013, so it's basically taken that Kinect technology and then just shrunk it down to the size of an iPhone.
How phenomenal. You see, good products are good products. There you go. Microsoft bought it. Apple bought it. Yep. Now the world's going to buy it. Yep. I think it's interesting. I was looking at password security, having a conversation with our network manager last week. About whether we're going to force everyone to have a longer password. So now all 9-character passwords, that's 9, not 8, we're including all 4 of the digit combinations, so uppercase, lowercase, symbol, number, are on a table, a database table now. So if you have access to that table, you can crack every single password that is below the 9 characters or below using those 4 different digits, no matter what combination. Wow. And so that's now standard security. So we were arguing the toss about risk assessment. So what is your threat, as you were saying earlier, and where our threats are, and whether we should go up to 16 character passwords.
What do you do personally?
Me? I said no. Yeah. I said, we stay on 8. I said, give me one use case where the password has been at fault because it's been hacked, because it's been guessed or cracked or whatever. And then we'll have another conversation. But when you do a risk assessment and a risk analysis, you're actually talking about, if you think about the number of times this password gets typed in, because it's the Wi-Fi connecting account, then it's this Active Directory. So it's what connects everyone to the Wi-Fi. Yeah. And and the number of times that people have to, because teachers and pupils are moving around machines during the day, although we're looking to reduce that and give people personal devices more. You're talking about number of hours of teaching and learning being consumed by typing passwords in if you multiply it across all the people.
I mean, even a password manager wouldn't work there because it's before you're in the operating system.
Yes, exactly. A password manager would only work if you were reading your app, a phone app, to type it in, but it wouldn't work as in putting it in, I don't think. You'd have to look at some other forms of authentication, which I've used before. We've had USB sticks, which have a pin on them. You just have a 6-digit pin, but you have to put the USB stick in to open the computer and then know the pin. So it's 2-factor authentication. But that becomes very boring. Very quickly in a school where you have to be quite dynamic and flexible with the kit that you're using because it's all multi-user.
Well, of course, and all the stuff we're talking about here is always going to be it's a trade-off between convenience and security. And one of the things, apparently from a previous Apple keynote, is that Apple users, on average, use Touch ID to unlock their phone 80 times a day.
Oh, yeah, I've just put that's an interesting on the note of that. I've just put an app on my phone. Is it still there? It looks like it's actually stopped working. That's really disappointing. It's been working fine for the last few days. It's called Quality Time. I don't know if it's on iPhone, but it's on iOS, but it's on Android. Yeah, it measures what you spend your time on your phone, how long you spend it on, how many times you unlock the screen, what apps you're on, you know, that kind of thing. And it sends you a report in the morning of what you did the day before. So I'm just doing it to have a look at. So I'm doing it with my lower six computer science class as this little side experiment to sort of see how much they're using their device. And then we can do a comparison of our data and what they spend their time on and what I spend my time on. But again, it's one of those things about self-awareness, isn't it? It's, you know, it's the Fitbit territory. It's, you modify your behavior when you've informed yourself of actually what that behavior is, because quite often human behavior is, absent of all the facts. Sometimes
it is crazy that we live in a world now where, you know, a 36-year-old man can say that he finds it strange to go for a walk, as I did yesterday, day before, for about an hour, and I didn't have my phone on me, and it felt weird, and yeah, to not look at a screen for an hour.
They're amazing things, aren't they? So yeah, I don't know. I enjoy having my phone with me, and I enjoy not using it. I enjoy it when it's dead and and just like not bothering me, kind of thing. And I'm not drawn to it. And over the summer holidays, I kind of was working on that quite a lot of just not, just trying to not even think about what was coming in, and having the tail wag of the dog that is me, kind of thing. And I do think that's where society's going to go. It's going to be, you know, holidays are going to be things that you do without your technology, and, you know, technology-free destinations are going to be a big deal. Although saying that, yeah, traveling alone, using sat-nav, driving through France was an absolute breeze. I didn't have to worry about anything. It was great.
Well, the interesting thing, I mean, one of the things from that Apple launch, the thing which really excited me, although I'm not going to get one, was the Apple Watch having a SIM card in. You see that?
Yes, it's gone cellular, hasn't it? So now it has cellular activity. That's a big deal for us. So in the boarding houses, in a couple of the year groups, we will remove their phones. I think we will have them kept centrally.
You were saying, yeah.
Yeah, and so Apple Watches, they're allowed to keep because they're 30 feet connectivity. But this is no longer going to be the case. So in exam halls, for example, you can't have an Apple Watch on because you could be sitting within reach of your phone. But now we're going to have to do that in the boarding house as well. They're not going to have their. They're going to. So if they wear an Apple Watch,
it's a never-ending battle. It's a futile battle, possibly. But
it's just what people see fit. It's not my call. It's what people see fit to do in the time.
Oh no, I wasn't saying it was your call, because I know that you've kind of campaigned against it, but.
I just think children using phones is a good thing, and the more you use them with them to do good stuff, the better they're going to use them, and the more they're going to learn about them.
University say, or one of the prestigious universities say, that they were going to start using laptops in exams because the reason they gave was the handwriting of their undergraduates was so poor.
Did they say that?
Mm.
That's really interesting. I think I mean, that's just going to require so much management, because the whole point about every computer in the world is that it, the easier it connects to the internet, the better. And so then to all of a sudden require a fleet of computers that do not connect to the internet is going to be quite tricky. I can speak from experience for the controlled assessments now called the non-examined assessments that we do in computer science GCSE. We're turning internet connections off. We have to run all sorts of scripts on the accounts and have special accounts for doing it and that kind of thing, which is just a lot of faff.
Indeed.
But we'll see. I know there was an independent school actually who I don't think it's not certainly not this summer. It might be last, or it might be the one before even. And they got all their pupils to use computers in exams because they were doing a BYOD one-to-one kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so all the stuff was word processed, and there's no internet access in the room, so they couldn't connect to it. And there was no Wi-Fi turned on or whatever.
Well, I mean, it does seem a bit anachronistic. I mean, for example, last night I have just become secretary of the local Scout Association, and so I now have to do the minutes. And I didn't take my laptop because it's not one of those kind of meetings, you know, I kind of have to tread softly a bit. And I was mentioning this beforehand that, you know, I type a lot faster than I write. And they're like, oh, no, bring your laptop next time, it'll be fine. But it's one of those things where when you're forced to write notes when you would usually type, it's really awkward.
Yeah, well, it can be. But anyway, this school were penalized and every single one of their exams was disqualified.
Oh, really? Sorry, yeah. I didn't realize you unfinished the story, right? Okay.
Yeah, sorry, punchline to come. So this school did this, and the board said, nope, sorry. Or the boards collectively, or maybe it was just
because
one board
said no. Because
they
assumed that it was unfair.
I don't know what quite the detail was. So I haven't read about this in the news, and I haven't seen it in the news. I know it was a big hoo-ha for the school, and the parents obviously were up in arms because all of their children's qualifications were wiped, or I don't know what compromise was come to, but it wasn't a front page thing, was it? I didn't see it coming through.
No, I didn't see it.
So don't tell anyone.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm pretty confident that that happened in some way, shape, or form, and the children's grades were in question. It was still under appeal, I think. So it was just after the summer that I heard about it 2 years ago, I think. Maybe. Yeah. Interesting. Anyway.
So you mentioned earlier that you kind of joked that the evil twin kind of attack vector was Apple's only way of introducing multiple accounts on iOS. One thing that I have been waiting for ages, and there are ways of doing this, there are ways in which you can hack Chrome and Firefox, or have multiple profiles, but it's not a straightforward way in which, let's say you want to use one of the major web browsers the same web browser for work and for home, and you want them to be completely separate. It's never been very easy, and so the easiest thing's always been to use one web browser made by one company for home and one web browser made by a different company for work. Well, now Mozilla, after fanning on doing all kinds of stuff, has eventually got round to Firefox multi-account containers built into Firefox, which means it says Firefox. It now means you can wrangle multiple email and social accounts.
Cool. I'm just trying to work out what browser I'm actually using now. I think I'm using Chromium, but I also use I use Chromium and Firefox. Oh no, I'm using Firefox. Let me see.
Crazy that we can't tell the difference, isn't it?
They kind of look the same. I could if I thought about it. Firefox has a deeper tab on it, but because I'm on Linux as well, then it's they all look a little bit different.
Yeah. No,
so,
that's true.
Okay, so that's that. It says download Firefox at the top though, so that's not a good sign. That's cool though. I like that idea. So I'm forever working in switching between browsers and have two browsers running. So I use four different browsers. I use Chrome, Chromium, Firefox, and Brave. And I on my phone I use Brave, Firefox, and Chrome. So I use multiple browsers, and I opt to use Brave wherever I can. That's my browser of choice. And I do that based on the fact that it's looking after me better than any of the others, I think. Yeah. Firefox I've tried with many times, and this current session on this machine with Firefox is the best I've ever had it. I think it's clean, it's fast, it's working well. I have right now 20 tabs open, and it's happy doing this, including the one we're recording this podcast on. I might give that a go. I think that sounds good.
Mm. So I've been using Firefox Developer Edition, which used to be Aurora, for personal stuff, and then Chromium for like work things. One of the things I did this summer only a few weeks ago, was I bought a 4K monitor.
Uh-huh.
So I got that Dell laptop at the start of the year, which has a 4K screen. Yeah. I was still using the monitor that Mozilla very kindly let me keep when I left, which was full HD. Now, this is like total first world problems, but what I found was when I connected my 4K screen to my full HD monitor, the kind of scaling went a bit funny. Then I'd have to change the scaling. And then when I disconnected it, the scaling would be like wrong the other way. And so I was doing it, you know, you do this several times a day and it just becomes very annoying. So I decided, well, if I'm working all the time and I'm earning more money, I am going to buy myself a 4K monitor. And it just happened to be I decided to do that at a time when there was an offer on. So I got it cheap and it is amazing.
I've now got
Chromium usually on my big monitor and Firefox personally on the smaller one. Okay. But Firefox Developer Edition is wonderful. And the feature, it sounds like such a small thing, but they've got this new thing. Have you seen this, Di, called Firefox Screenshots?
No, I haven't.
Have a look at the top right-hand corner of your Firefox window. Have you got like some little scissors?
No, I haven't.
Oh, which version of Firefox are you using?
I have no idea. I've just installed it. So, oh, maybe it's the one that came in the machine, actually.
Anyway, they do test things out on Developer Edition. And I really like it. It has this kind of black theme to it, and the developer tools are built in and all that kind of stuff. But Firefox Screenshots, what it does is when you press it, in a bit the same way that you would use Awesome Screenshot, which is the extension I've been using before this. And as when I showed it to one person, they were like, this has been the reason that I've kept using a Mac. Now I feel like I can use any machine. What it does is when you press it and you mouse over different parts of the page, you know, like when you use... Sorry?
It highlights the chunk.
It highlights the chunk, like on X-ray goggles.
Yeah.
Or when you're using the developer tools.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can just screenshot that bit there. And then it has like a cloud-based save thing, or you can just download it straight away. It's fantastic.
Sounds good.
Mm.
I need to see which version. I'm using 55.0.2, 64-bit. What are you on?
55.0.2. Okay.
I'm not going to do any updates because we're recording on this. I'm on this recording. So, cool. I'm going to give that a go. Well done, Firefox. It's about time you did something, because I thought they were about to die in Mozilla for a while.
Well, I think this is the last throw of the dice, to be fair.
Well, let's see how it works.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. What should we go next? We're on, in terms of recording time, we're on 1 hour and 2 minutes. Where do you want to go next?
Coming soon, a university where students could set their own tuition fees. What's that all about? Guardian article.
So this is the Cooperative University, which is something which has been mooted by the Cooperative College. So if you remember a few months back, I presented on behalf of our co-op at the Cooperative Education and Research Conference at the Cooperative College in Manchester.
I do remember that, yes.
And I was actually invited to a meeting next month. Is it next month? Yeah, next month. To kind of kick off this thing or to kind of investigate a bit more fully. Unfortunately, it's a really awkward time, so I can't go. But what it's trying to say is that we need different types of universities because they're all just following the same model. And the one of the ones which is referenced in here, there's all different ones, like the Ragged University in Edinburgh, and Free University Brighton. But the one that I know a little bit about is the Social Science Centre in Lincoln. Mm-hmm. A guy called Mike Neary, who's a professor there, and Joss Wynn, who's a senior lecturer, they've been under the auspices of the university or connected to the university in some way, it's kind of a peer teaching thing where you do get accreditation as a result of doing these courses. But the courses are, you pay kind of what you want or what you can afford. And yeah, it's just a really different kind of model. So with a cooperative university, they're just trying to reimagine higher education, but not in a Pearson kind of reimagining education kind of way, but actually trying to think, what are we doing when we do higher education?
Mm.
Yep. So it's an interesting post.
Yeah, I'm just reading this. The Cooperative College's working group is looking into two main models for a cooperative industry. One is trying to gain degree awarding powers itself, the other forming a federation of higher education cooperatives. Another possibility is that different departments and services at existing universities, student accommodation, for example, or a philosophy department, develop into cooperatives under an overall university banner.
Yep.
It's quite interesting.
It's so interesting. You know, I've been spending time on social.coop, which is an instance of Mastodon, which is owned by its users. So mm-hmm. I pay money every month, like I've said before, and I get to vote on stuff. I'm going to start community calls, and we've been voting on logos and all that kind of stuff. Because I'm on that and because everyone is interested on that particular instance in cooperatives, just the amount of stuff I start reading about what's happening around cooperation around the world, it's just not reported in mainstream press very much. And it is little stuff here and there, etc. But it makes you kind of hopeful about the future.
Yeah, no, I think that is interesting. And in this, I mean, the cooperative model, I think, is a business model, for want of a better word, that it's always been appealing, you know, the idea where, you know, companies give their employees shares within the company because they consider it an appropriate methodology or motivational participation, I guess, or whatever, force, I don't know. But it just makes a lot of sense. And the idea that students, I mean, I'm certainly struck that students who go to university that I've taught that have come back to see me, which I guess says something about the characters involved, are much more business-like. They work much harder. They work every day. They do that. When I was at university, I worked when I had a lecture, which wasn't that often. And then a piece of work to hand in, I'd scrape the barrel of my discipline to get something together at certain times during my university career, which was not glittering at all.
It's funny. We seem to be doing the opposite of what we should be doing sometimes. One thing, I think I mentioned this to you when we had a chat off air, as it were, last week, but this sounds petty and sounds like not a big deal, but to my mind, it's symptomatic of a particular mindset. So in Morpeth, where I live, up until last academic year, the students at the high school, which is one of the most successful, if not the most successful, secondary place of education in the Northeast. Yeah, it's like amazingly successful school, uh-huh. King Edward VI School in Morpeth.
I was supposed to go to that school, but I moved.
Yeah, because you were going to go from Chantry, yeah.
That's right.
So it's always had like a polo shirt and a jumper. Yeah, that's been the thing. Yeah, and mm-hmm. I've worked in schools that had polo shirts and jumpers, and it is the best uniform because you never have to have a conversation with kids about uniform. Because it doesn't matter, yeah?
Yeah.
And if you have the polo shirt outside of the trousers, it doesn't matter. Anyway, as of this year, I thought, hang on, they look different. And yeah, they're wearing blazers and ties. Now, I can understand why historically you might have blazers and ties if your school has always had that. But to move to that in 2017, like, ties are completely impractical. Who wears a tie in the workplace unless you work in a university or a school? Nobody. Blazers are the most impractical things in the entire world for any kind of situation. And when I started talking about this with someone I know, they said that at their daughter's school, they're not allowed to take the blazer off in a classroom unless the teacher tells them to. It just seems like the most draconian, backwards way of thinking. And I don't really care what uniform they've got, to be quite honest, but it's just a way of thinking that this is the thing that we should do to appease parents or whatever, when actually we should be focused on students and their learning as opposed to anything else. Because I can guarantee what's happening at that school up the road. It's only 200 meters up the road from me. I can guarantee that every single day teachers are honored students about uniform in a way that they weren't last year.
It's interesting. So King Edward was what I would call proper uniform, because I've never worked in a school with anything else. And that's, I've worked in some tough state schools. That's what it was when I was there. When I was due to go, I remember seeing all the children walking around, and friends of mine who were older were in it. And they've gone to that. But I think it is, there are certain things about that happen as society develops. And one is the relaxation of clothing expectations and norms to sensible, smart, casual kind of dress, which is what you're reflecting there. And it's an important point that you make, that there is never a conversation about uniform. What I would say, though, is that there's possibly an argument in the idea that addressing a pupil's uniform is a very minor, low-level rejection of the code of conduct, very easy to deal with as a teacher in comparison to high-level things. And discipline, in my experience, in both high-achieving and low-achieving schools, is much better dealt with if you're dealing, nipping things in the bud at an early stage and setting the tone for things.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. But wouldn't you say that just ends up with a stream of negativity?
Yes. I mean, I think, so in when I worked in the state sector, and uniform standards were different in different schools, and having to address the uniform was too oppressive, especially when there's worse behavior going on. So then you end up just not actually addressing the minor stuff. And then what happens is the standard of what the uniform looks like and how people are wearing it slips enormously, and people look like they are on default rebellious kind of thing. Not playing ball, not being cooperative, not doing it as is expected. And that's that. So we deal with lots of uniform issues here at my school, but that's part of what I just said before of you know, dealing with little minor things. The uniform is generally very smartly worn by the majority of every pupils and teachers, and a suit is just a uniform of its own, really, and the professional workwear. And we have a really odd uniform here, so our female pupils wear culottes, so really wide, long trousers that go down all the way to the shoe, look like a big long skirt, but they're actually trousers. And they really like them. And the sixth form girls were given the option of changing to suits because our sixth form boys wear suits. And they didn't want to. They wanted to keep their culottes and blazers. And because they can wear their pajamas underneath the culottes or whatever, and there's massive pockets in them, so they can carry all this, they're like bags, you know. And they have these advantages. And I kind of think, well, when they get out of school, they're going to have to start to learn about wearing workwear and professional workwear. And the sooner they learn about that in a sort of safe environment where it's, you know, of little consequence if they get it wrong, the better. They learn about hem lengths and cut of skirt and that kind of thing. So I don't know.
I'm in a little bubble, but I haven't worn anything apart from jeans for work or otherwise for years. So.
Well, I wear a suit and a waistcoat and a tie and a double cuff shirt with a collar, obviously. And
two tie and no shoes.
And no shoes, yeah. No, I don't. I teach in shoes. Although I'm developing at the moment a pair of shoes where I'm going to cut the soles out, and so I can be barefoot, but everyone thinks I'm wearing shoes. That's my
barefoot. Excellent.
Exactly. But I'm not sure that's going to work. I think they're just going to flop about like a pair of flippers. But we'll see.
Like a wet haddock on your foot.
Yes. Anyway, so I don't think, but I do like the idea. I always think about these things. Well, if I was designing a school, what would I put in place? And there's definitely a value in public perception. There's definitely an effect, an impact in public perception and what that means. But I don't necessarily think it's the real deal. Always, you know what I mean? And I think what you said about having conversations about uniform is simply dull and a waste of time.
I remember when I taught at Ridgewood in Doncaster, which was a high performing, had two specialisms, vocational learning and engineering, you know, again, high results, etc. And one of the parents said something about like blazers or whatever. And the the headmaster, who was, you know, an Oxford man, just looked at them and just went, "We're an engineering school. Like, do you want your child to be like choked to death with a tie in a drill or what are you talking about, you crazy person?"
I mean, I do feel that sometimes. So computing, in my opinion, any good computer science department's a bit messy. And you're on your hands and knees with wires and you're taking bits of kit apart that got dust in them and whatever. And you don't really want to be in a suit when you're doing that. You know, you want to be getting your sleeves rolled up and getting on with it. But, you know, that's not the way it is.
Well, talking about things which we do, which are pretty pointless, there's an interesting thing in The Guardian about, it's by Simon Jenkins, and it's entitled "Crushing Morale, Killing Productivity. Why do officers put up with meetings?" And the graphic on this, the illustration by Ben Jennings, who I should say I used to follow on Twitter, really interesting guy, is a top-down view of a meeting table shaped like a coffin. It's fantastic.
Oh, that is great. I'm just looking at it. That's fantastic. And you've got all the people doing all the things on their different devices. One's sketching and doodling, one's asleep, and one's just looking at his watch. It's probably an Apple Watch with cellular independence. I think this is really interesting, isn't it? Meetings can be, I mean, I've had a day of meetings today. So I taught the first two lessons out of eight, and then the rest of the day has been filled with meetings of different sorts. And the two main ones were quite productive, really. They just needed decisions making. But I do feel I'm in the process of doing this, but I'm going to try and shift some of the workflow onto Trello because I just think a lot of it, things just take too long. I want to get a little bit more agile, a little faster in the way that things are done. And to do that, people need to keep up. And I think out of meeting, as it were, rather than having to have a meeting to discuss every issue. So you can just set action points on Trello and update them when things are done and link in Google Docs and whatever. So I'm looking at that at the moment as a way of streamlining that thing, because I just think people's time gets usurped. And if, you know, my job is taken up so much with talking to children in one-to-one or one-to-two or one-to-three situations outside of lesson time in odd places, and you kind of make a decision, you make an agreement, and the quality of my work is based on how well I follow all of those things up, because children being children, they're not going to, even if they are doing the thing that I said, they're not going to tell me about it. So it's quite difficult. But I agree with this. It's a lovely picture.
It is fantastic. I forgot another blog post I wrote, and the reason I forgot about it was because I only publish it on LinkedIn, which I hardly ever do. I usually just post on my own stuff and then put it somewhere else, as I was mentioning before. But this particular one is about... So there's a guy called John O'Dwin, who was at Mozilla at the same time as me, but our paths didn't really overlap. And he managed a remote team, and he managed the release engineering team, which at the time he took over had the average person stayed there about 6 months. It was really toxic kind of culture, high pressure environment, that kind of thing. And by the time, you know, 2 years later, by the time he'd kind of experimented with different things, he had people working across some like 8 different time zones. The average tenure had gone up to 18 months, all this kind of stuff. And he talks about distributed teams and why and how to do it. And he's writing a book at the moment, and I'm on the list for the kind of early release version of it, and I end up writing this blog post as a result. And I think there's a lot, you know, I've worked from home, been based remotely for the last 5 years, and I think there's a lot that any organization can learn from kind of a remote first policy, including using things that we use, Dai, like Slack or in fact, there's a new one, HipChat. So Totro, who I'm doing some work with at the moment, Totro Learning, they're using something called HipChat. And when I logged in the other day, they are basically doing a new version of workplace chat, which is called Stride, and they're going to migrate everyone to it. But the interesting thing from the blog post which announced it is that whereas on Slack you feel like you're always on, with HipChat you can press like a do not disturb deep dive button, and it'll you know, not notify you. And then when you come back, it only shows you the most important stuff, what you need to catch up on.
Cool.
I think the thing that people aren't very good at is making decisions without being in the same place at the same time.
Yes, I think that's tough, isn't it? And that's kind of okay in a way, sort of, but it is a difficult thing. I had a really interesting, one of those meetings today included a conversation actually about migrating away from email towards an app for communications within the school. So using email for external communications and for other particular scenarios, but all of our communication would migrate from email onto something like Slack. So I'm going to be looking in the next sort of over this academic year at different communication apps like Slack or like Microsoft Teams will be one we look at and see what that's like in used in anger and the ones you mentioned, HipChat possibly and whatever, would do the job.
And it's the self-hosted ones as well, like Riot.im, Mattermost, and there's another one as well, I've forgotten.
Yeah, so I'll be looking at those and looking at and then trying to use them in small groups of different people to see how they would work in anger. It's going to be
the way. So some of the benefits, I think, aren't immediately obvious. So again, I mentioned the scouts meeting last night, taking over a secretary, and I was trying to point out that, you know, to use the word that you mentioned before, workflow, trying to just improve that, because I think not only can the meetings be run better, but we can make decisions without having to meet, etc. And one of the things I was trying to point out was that we shouldn't be using personal email for things like chairman emails or official executive committee business. You know, if you've got a role on it, because when you pass over to someone else, inevitably you're going to resign at some point, and someone else is going to take over. You don't want to have to forward lots of emails, and I think that's the thing the kind of workplace chat does best. If you pay for the archive function, it means that you've got every interaction, basically, unless you're doing it by email, of course, with somebody external, in which case you have to go in and explain what it is that you've done. So the way that we're going to try and just get around that is just by having like a Google Apps account for each particular person on the committee. But I think that workplace chat, it's one of those things where it's still in its infancy. And the guy who I would definitely read if you're doing that research is Stowe Boyd. Do you follow him on Twitter?
Yeah, I do. Name rings a bell, but yeah.
Stowe Boyd and Esko Kilpie. So they blog in lots of places, but it's called workfutures.io, I think. And it's a Medium-powered blog. And it talks about all kinds of stuff about the future of work. But some really good stuff in there about workplace chat and some of the things that I hadn't thought about. So.
Okay. Well, I'll have a look at that. Thank you.
What's next then?
What's that you've got as learning as artifact creation? What's that about?
This is George Siemens. Have you come across his work before?
Yes, I have.
I love the fact that George hasn't changed his blog theme for the last 10 years. I think that's fantastic.
That's pretty clean and simple, isn't it?
And the size of the font is ridiculously small.
It is, yes.
But
is it adaptive?
Sorry, go on.
Is it adaptive? How does it look when it goes small? No, it just disappears. Fantastic. So it's not
responsive in the slightest. He also doesn't know how to use categories. So if you go right to the top of the blog, his categories are, or his links for navigation are home, about, test, and RIP J Cross.
I like test. I'm going to put a test category on my blog.
Oh, it's the future. It's the future. Uncategorized is my favorite, because by your, you know, if you put something in there, by definition,
or you could have something like beta, couldn't you? Or alpha and beta. Quite like that. Quite like the idea. Read this bit. These are not quite finished.
Yeah.
So what's this about anyway? Learning is artifact creation.
So he's talking about, you know, Web 2.0. He's talking about people like Dewey and Illich and Ferrer and Montessori and people like that. Uh-huh. And he says that the stuff that we're used to, like he says, learning artifacts, a paper or a test, were largely held between the instructor and student. Group work and class presentations brought others into the relationship, but the message was still clear. The instructor and the content were central. All else was held in their orbit. Then the internet happened, and later the web. Small groups of people could share without a mediator. You didn't need a publisher to blast your thoughts to a bulletin board. Yahoo Groups, Friendster, and other early social software didn't fully live up to the vision of the mesh, but they enabled communication. content creation was still largely the domain of experts or people in positions of control, Britannica and newspapers were still gatekeepers. Then the late 90s rolled around and Blogger, and then he talks about Web 2.0, etc. And all these opportunities for students, and that what we need to be doing is getting them to create artifacts that can then be shared with other people. And how that is about learning, and learning by making stuff and doing, and not just doing stuff with your hands, but, you know, making virtual stuff. It's an argument which has been made lots of times by other people as well. The interesting thing is that some people disagreed with this, which I find it difficult to do. The reason he's writing about this is because he and Stephen Downes are doing a new course. So back in 2004, or a while ago, he did a course, like one of the first MOOCs, and around connectivism with Stephen Downes. And he's doing a new one, which if I find... Yeah, he's doing a new MOOC. And the way that they do MOOCs with kind of connectivist style things, it's a learning analytics one. The way that they do it, you kind of create the curriculum with other people and yourself, etc., rather than just doing something which has been preordained.
Mm-hmm. That'd be interesting. I think there's definite value in what they're arguing, and it just the idea that people get to create their own things. But I think it's also it's a difficult thing when you're trying to assess it. That's all.
It's the signaling of what it is that you've done and what was the value of it, which is the hard thing. But if you think about, what are the situations in which we need to signal? I mean, this could be a whole rabbit hole, which we don't need to go down in terms of accreditation and credentials and stuff. But the situations in which we need to signal to people that we don't know the stuff that we can do, I would say, are increasingly rare, because we're either connected to people because we have a reputation, and you know, people know of us, or we know people through networks, friends of a friends, or whatever it is. So we have much more of a social way of, for example, getting jobs or whatever it is. So the situation where someone has never heard of you, and you're going for a job or for a position or to try and influence them or whatever, I would say is reducing. I'm not saying it's zero, obviously not. And it also often depends on how old you are, what stage of your career you're at, etc. But I feel like we're using the wrong model in terms of, well, you have to access all of these credentials, because at some point you're going to have to prove what you can do or what you know to people who've never heard of you. Like, it just seems to be a outdated concept.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting thing I've been looking at recently in Oxbridge applications. So I've got six pupils applying for Oxbridge to study. Two are studying computer science, one maths, and whether we include an online portfolio of their digital endeavours to date, because they've all done lots, because they're very bright pupils, and much brighter than me, and code for pudding, you know, kind of thing, And so they have these projects, and I'm wondering whether they should have created online portfolios for them or not. So we got some advice back from an admissions tutor for a Cambridge college, I think. And they said that it wouldn't do them any favors, because it's outside of the application process that's set and is fair, level playing field for everybody. It wouldn't do them any harm.
It's not going to do any harm, though, is it, really? I mean,
do any favors for them either. And it's
good practice as well.
But the work that they've done is outstanding. You know, if people looked at it, I mean, I know that it's theirs, but I guess other people wouldn't.
And also, you don't always know who you're creating stuff for. And that's one of the wonderful things about the web.
Mm.
You know, I've been in situations on video calls with people who I thought I didn't know, or I've got consulting gigs that I thought were just random, but actually it was because I had a conversation with someone, or someone saw my work randomly 5 years ago, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And you don't know who you're speaking to, because people see stuff that you didn't necessarily you didn't intend for them to see, you didn't stop them from seeing it, but you didn't, which is why working openly and sticking your stuff out there is such a wonderful thing to do.
Okay, I'm going to have to wrap this up shortly because someone's ringing on my bell from inside the boarding house.
Okay.
I need to go and do my job.
Well, let's stop there. But the stuff we didn't get to, which we'll still include in the show notes, if you're interested, there is a conversation in the TES with Jung-Suk Lee, which is problematizing the notion of cultural capital. So if you're listening to this and you think, oh, yes, I know all about cultural capital, then do read this because it's quite a nuanced post, which is great. The Secret Teacher, the regular thing in The Guardian about Secret Teacher, says it's a really good one for me to be able to point to because I've had conversations with, I remember having a conversation with Oliver Quinlan about this a few years ago, about whether being a parent makes you a better teacher or not.
I think we've discussed that Untied before, more than once, to be honest, because it's a natural thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. There's a thing in here which uses the concept of or the lens of feudalism, as in, you know, being a serf in the Middle Ages, and saying that the Internet of Things is sending us back to that kind of situation. And then the last one, which is really interesting. So Mike, who writes a blog at Hapgood, he was talking about how do we... So basically what he says, I'll sum it up like this. He says, if I did some work for Google as a consultant and they paid me by buying me a car, the tax man would come along and go, oh, look, that is a taxable item. We're going to tax you as that's a benefit in kind. Yeah, that's the way that it works. But Google gets all of its value, and Facebook, etc., gets most of its value from harvesting our data, but isn't taxed on all of that value, that data. Oh. So he's saying that what we should do is, if people hang for every year that people are hanging on to our personal data, they should be taxed on it.
I thought
it was inherently reasonable.
I think I think that's the only thing that's not reasonable about it is that it's not done, and therefore it's not the current practice, and therefore it doesn't happen. I do think there are going to come. I mean, I think governments are scared and running. If the EU and the US cannot challenge GAFA, I heard them called the other day, Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. They're referred to it. That's how they're referred to within the EU. So it's the EU or US are going to challenge those companies, and if they don't, it's not going to happen. And if they, you know, and the problem is that these continents want their business, want them working in, because they are the biggest companies in the world. So it's quite interesting. But I think this is going to be a way, you know, they're going to have to leak it in slowly in the first instance and start doing that, because I do think it's not okay the way that people are having their data taken to make money for these organizations. And
It needs to be done at a regulatory level, I think, because for obvious reasons, GAFA aren't going to build the kind of tools which allow you to see what's really going on.
No, of course.
Yeah. Okay, what are you up to this next week until next Tuesday? It's Tuesday the 19th of September today?
Yeah, so I'm just in, third weekend, I'm just settling into it. We've got a field weekend this weekend, which means the youngest pupils all go back and see their parents, and then the entire fourth form and some others go to the Somme for centenary remembrance services, and to do the whole going to the, just going to very serious remembrance things. There's about 250, 300 people doing that. I will be doing teacher tech time and teaching my lessons and starting my non-examined assessment with my year 11s, which is kind of scary because it's all the first time. It's the first time we've done it.
Oh, it's the new spec, yeah.
Under the new spec, yeah, with no internet access and very, very different regulations to what went before, including regulations they put out that no teacher is able to discuss the NEA outside of the NEA. It's like Fight Club. It's hilarious. So, and to the extent that they were not, at one point they were saying that students weren't allowed to discuss it outside of the room.
Like that's gonna happen.
Well, I know, and what you know, what's that about? But that, you know, I've always worked with these things with the notion of a spirit of the specification, and trying to work within those, that guidance, yes. And to work fairly and honestly, and it's a difficult challenge, yeah. So we'll be doing that for the first time. Yeah, that's all I can think of. Oh, I'm now a football coach, so I'll be teaching football on Saturday afternoon. Yeah, that will to 11 and 12 year olds, which is quite funny. And other than that, life is, it's just all, you know, all systems go, back at work. Yep. How about yourself?
Yep. So I'm doing 3 days a week with Totra at the moment. They are moving their community from Totra Learn, which is, you know, the equivalent of Moodle. They forked from Moodle a while ago. To Totra Social, which is a much improved kind of social learning platform, which was originally Mahara. So helping them with that. And then Badge Wiki, which is, it's just a badge.wiki, which is what our co-op is, it's a knowledge base for the Open Badges community. So doing a barn raising for that, so like a community call tomorrow. It's Scout Camp at the weekend, which I'll be helping out with. Ben is doing trials for East Northumberland football, which is fantastic.
Oh, wow. And, cool. Good luck, Ben.
He's doing pretty well. And then, yeah, next week we'll have to record Tide on Monday night if you're around, because I will be on a train to Brighton next Tuesday evening.
Okay, we'll have to work that out because I'm not around on Monday night. But we'll find a time, probably.
Yeah.
All right, well, have a good week.
All right. Well, thanks very much for listening, everybody, and have a good week yourself.
Take care, everyone.
At the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.